Health Institute. I've got some materials here, which I'll put in the back at the end, or you can come up and get them. But the research that I'll be presenting today was done for my dissertation at the PhD program in public policy at George Washington University. So we know anecdotally that female legislators are often the driving forces behind reproductive health, but we have seen very little research that actually looks at the relationship between the gender of members of Congress and how that associates with their positions on reproductive health. And even less attention has been paid to the language that women employ. So this presentation is going to look at gender in a different context, halfway around the world from Malawi, looking at the politics and really as a policy geek getting into the details of this stuff. So my study aimed to answer the questions: are women in the U.S. House of Representatives more likely to vote and to speak on behalf of international reproductive health and rights than their male counterparts? And then what is the tone of discourse that male and female members employ when they're discussing these issues? Because there were so few women in legislatures historically, little was written on women's roles in the legislature and the relationship with their votes until about the 1970s, and this is despite the fact that reproductive health issues have been voted on by Congress for about 150 years now. Much of the early literature considered women's issues writ large, sometimes including but rarely specific to issues related to family planning and abortion, for example. And also because of the larger sample size that they offered, state legislatures tended to be the focus more than the U.S. Congress early on. So I'll just quickly go through some of the literature that has been out there. Frankovich, for example, looked at votes between 1961 and 75, when there were only 4% female representation in Congress. And he found that women in Congress were more liberal than their male counterparts, even controlling for other factors. There were several studies in the 80s that reaffirmed the notion that female representatives were more liberal and more feminist than their male colleagues. There were studies that found at the state level, for example, that women legislators' priorities included more attention to issues related to women and children. And also some studies that found that as the proportion of women in legislatures increased, so too did the tendency of male legislators to introduce and support legislation related to women and children. Rheingold found that female legislators tended to see themselves as representatives of women and uniquely able to represent the interests of women. So with the 1992 elections leading to the historic, quote, year of the woman, women's representation in Congress jumped from 6% to 10%, and opportunities to research women's legislative behavior increased. Dodson and Swears looked at the 103rd Congress, that's 93 to 95, and they found that gender exerts a significant and independent effect on voting on women's issues, even controlling for other factors. This effect was most significant on issues related to women's health and abortion. Dodson's interviews with women members of Congress support the idea that women members do see themselves as responsible for representing interests of women, and you see a quote here by a Republican member: women have to speak up for the things that affect women because the men don't. In addition to actual roll call voting, there's evidence to suggest that women frame discussions around abortion specifically in different ways than men do. Levy, Tan, and Aved, for example, suggest that as their representation in Congress has increased, women have been able to shift the debate around abortion from a focus on the morality of the procedure to one more focused on the woman's health. They use content analysis of debates around the Hyde Amendment and find considerable differences in the language that women use as compared to men, and they also find that female members differed in their actual positions on Hyde as men, and they conclude by arguing that greater numbers of women in Congress will lead to greater representation of women's interests. So I looked in my study at votes on the Mexico City policy in the United States House of Representatives during the 104th through 110th Congress. This is 95 to 2007. The Mexico City, I'm sure, needs no defining to many in this room, but very briefly, it was so named because of its origins at the 1984 International Conference on Population and Development that took place in Mexico City. The U.S. delegation to that conference announced a new policy at the time of denying family planning funds to any foreign non-governmental organization that provided, counseled on, or lobbied on abortion, even with their own resources. And this policy was implemented by President Reagan in 84, rescinded by Clinton in 93, reinstated by George Bush in 2001, and rescinded by Obama in 2009. Well, the U.S. Congress has attempted many times over the years to legislate the Mexico City policy either into or out of existence. And I assessed for my study all votes on the Mexico City policy that came to the floor of the House of Representatives during this time period. Looking at the association between a member's gender, party, and vote. So the policy came to the floor 8 separate times during this time period, and in some cases there were competing amendments, so 2 votes on the same day, and in some cases I just looked at the positions for and against. And I'll admit there's some simplification here when I say pro or support, anti or oppose, because each time the amendment was presented, it might have been slightly different. For example, the 2007 amendment was on a contraceptive exemption, but most organizations have coded that as pro or anti Mexico City. So I looked at both vote counts and floor debates. Vote counts are clear, obvious markers of support of or opposition to a bill. Why did I look at floor debates? Floor speeches, floor statements provide an opportunity for lawmakers to attempt to influence others to support or oppose a bill, or to strengthen or weaken the resolve of a bill's supporters or opponents. And also, lawmakers use floor speeches to display their positions publicly. So examining the content of floor statements can help in understanding the depth of a legislator's knowledge, expertise, and passion around issues. And finally, I hope that understanding the language and the meaning behind the actual positions of members of Congress can help ascertain whether there are certain strategies or messages that can be used effectively in the future. Looking at Mexico City policy votes over a 12-year period enabled me to compare votes on the same issue over the course of different political contexts. So for example, Republican-led or Democratic-led Congresses, and when there were different proportions of women in the Congress. I looked at voting patterns, as well as how many members by gender and party spoke on the House floor in support of or in opposition to Mexico City. I also conducted a content analysis, where I analyzed floor debates to assess the content and tone of the discourse that was employed by male and female Democrat and Republican members. The content analysis covered 3 complete debates on the House floor at the time of roll call voting for votes in 95, 97, and 2000. I'm still coding 2007. In all, I've coded just about 54,000 words, which comprised over 1,100 distinct interventions or statements or short statements. So what did I find? Looking first at the proportion of women in the House of Representatives. In 95, the 104th Congress, women represented only 11% of the House. This number has increased slowly. In 2007 and 2010, for that matter, it was 17%. And on average, over this time period, about a third of the women were Republicans. Just a quick note, while the results of this year's elections are not quite yet finalized, it looks like there will be about the same representation of women in Congress, although the proportion of Republican women is increasing from roughly a quarter to a third. This is both the House and the Senate. So looking at vote counts specifically, you can see that support for the Mexico City policy has become increasingly partisan over time, with a far lower percentage of Democrats, the blue lines at the bottom, supporting efforts to legislate Mexico City policy into existence than Republicans, the red and pink at the top. And you can see that this gap has widened over time. You can also see that female members, represented by the light blue bar at the bottom and the pink in the middle, supported the Mexico City policy at significantly lower proportions than their male counterparts. Looking at floor statements, Remember, these are opportunities for members to share their positions most publicly. We see that by party, statements correlate closely with vote counts. So at the top graph, you can see that consistently more Republicans, the red bars, came to the House floor to speak in support of the Mexico City policy than Democrats, the blue bars. But looking at the bottom graph, you can see that a good proportion or a good number of Republicans have also come to speak publicly in opposition to the policy at a greater proportion than they vote against it. So this is perhaps an indication of the strength of feeling that these members have around this issue. You can also see on the chart that this is going up through time. Like with the vote count, the proportion of Republicans who are willing to come to the House floor against the policy has declined over time. So now looking at gender, recall that women represented only 11 to 17% of all members in the House during this time. So it's really quite striking to see how many women came to the House floor to speak against this policy. Looking at the top chart, you see that women spoke in support of the Mexico City policy at roughly the same rates as their proportion in Congress. So between about 8 and 21%, just a few percentage points difference from their overall representation. But below, you see that women represented 35 to 65% of those speaking on the House floor. This is a rate that's 3 to 6 times higher than their representation in Congress. So clearly this is an issue about which women members feel strongly. Okay, looking at the tone of interventions, I used qualitative analysis software to code the three debates line by line to try to assess whether each intervention had a positive, negative, or neutral tone. Statements that were clearly positive, negative, or neutral were coded as such. Those which were kind of fuzzy and weren't so clear, as well as those that were strictly procedural, were coded as neutral. I coded every line in the context of the greater intervention in which it was made, and some lines could be coded both positively and negatively. And I looked at the tone in regard to the amendment under consideration, as well as the broader issues around reproductive health in regard to statements about other members and other random issues that came up during the course of the debates. So just to give you a few examples of positively toned statements made by people on either side of the debate. First one, the Smith Amendment reinstates a sound policy that was in effect under the Reagan and Bush administrations. It's a policy that reflects the views of most Americans. This statement was made in support of the Mexico City policy and has a clear positive tone, as does this one made by an opponent of the policy. No one can deny that the need for family planning in developing countries is urgent, and the aid that we provide is both valuable and worthwhile. So some examples of negative tone by those supportive of Mexico City policy. First one, quote, "So if you think that it's a good idea and a helpful idea, there are just too many people in the world, and once they get created in the womb, exterminate them. Then this is a good amendment." The amendment of the gentlewoman from Maryland, in this case Representative Marilla, is form without substance. So those are supportive of Mexico City, and then those opposed. "The language we're striking restricts the use of a foreign NGO's own funds. In America, this language is unconstitutional. Around the world, it is unconscionable. The Mexico City policy restrictions are pernicious, unnecessary, and harmful. They would severely limit family planning efforts and result in more unwanted pregnancies, more fatalities among women, and more abortions." So as these charts hopefully show, the red circles there represent the negative words. And as you can see, of the 54,000 words that I've coded, the vast majority were negative, both coming from those in support of and in opposition to the Mexico City policy. Far smaller proportions, the top positive tones, were positive, particularly from those in support of the policy. So in other words, if you support the Mexico City policy, you are very unlikely to use a positive tone when you're speaking on the House floor. We see on this chart the top black line representing the male members, and they were significantly more likely to use negative language in their interventions than females, the pink line at the bottom. Between 55% and 75% of the interventions by male members of Congress were negative. Women were also likely to use a negative tone in their interventions, that pink line, but at a lower rate, about 50 to 62% of the time. I want to turn now to the use of a couple of words that I found interesting in my coding. So I use a word cloud here to represent the text of the debates. These clouds represent the top 30 words of three letters or more that appeared in the debates. The size of the word, as you probably know from word clouds, represents the number of times that that word was used in the debate. So the bigger the word, the more times it was used. These, of course, look different whether you're looking at the positive tone, negative tone, support or opposed, but this is the combined debate, and you can see a couple of things happening over time. So this is 95. Look at the word population. It appears fairly frequently in 1995 in the debate. It was used 94 times. Gets a little smaller here. It was used only 83 times in 1997. And then it doesn't place at all in the top 30 in the year 2000. In fact, it ranks 191st of words that were used. It was mentioned only 11 times. Now, most of the references to population in these debates has been around population growth or population control, and this is a message or this term that is used infrequently over time now in these Mexico City policy debates. By the way, in 2007, the last time Mexico City policy came up, the word population was the 224th most used word. The second thing I wanted to point out is the number of references to women. This increases over time. So in 1995, it was used 51 times. In 1997, it was used 79 times. And in the last debate in 2000, it was used 105 times. Overwhelmingly and increasingly over time, mentions of women are made by those who are opposed to the Mexico City policy. And these references appear, for example, in the context of women dying in pregnancy, women suffering from botched illegal abortions, women wanting contraception, women's rights, and so forth. And those who support the Mexico City policy, here the black line, who do use, who reference women, and they do so very rarely, do so in regard to women in America who oppose abortion, campaigns against women in China, incarceration of pregnant women in China, and so forth, as well as, of course, references to women whose children are poisoned and dismembered in the womb, so back to the morality of abortion that's employed by those who support the Mexico City policy. So finally, yes, as we would expect, the references to women in these debates are made more frequently by female members than they are by male. And to conclude, if you take the Mexico City policy as a proxy, then I would argue that there is evidence to indicate that female members do tend to support international reproductive health and rights in greater proportions than their male counterparts, both in their voting patterns and in their willingness to speak on the floor of the House. There's evidence to suggest that the increasing partisanship that we've seen in Washington in the past couple of decades is exemplified in debates around international reproductive health. And finally, there's evidence to suggest that women representatives do represent the interests of women around the world more frequently and somewhat more positively than men, though in general, the tone of these debates remains highly negative. Thank you.